best we've got unless we retask a U-2 or Global Hawk. The general frowned, leaned back in his leather chair, and closed his eyes for so long that Levi began to wonder if he'd fallen asleep. When Balls opened them again, he shook his head slowly.
If Big John says there's an 80% correlation, that's good enough for me. Retasking those assets dedicated to Southwest Asia would be too visible. As good as Gregory is, I don't want to risk tipping him off.
General Wilson rose to his feet, walked around the big oak desk, and clapped Elias on the back as he walked him toward the door.
Damn fine work, Levi. Looks like it's time for me to chat with the president. This time, he'll have to make the call.
Chapter 41. Heather leaned back in the chair and pulled the alien headband from her temples. Half a dozen feet away, Mark and Jennifer also came out of their lynx. The wind came in off the sloping hills, damp and clammy, whipping Heather's hair around her face as she turned her gaze toward Jack. 3 months ago, she'd been sure the Bandolier ship's creators had good intentions toward Earth. Now she was pretty sure that wasn't true. It was time to give Jack the bad news. What began as a conversation among Jack, Mark, Heather, and Jennifer quickly expanded to include Janet as she glided silently out through the screen door. Heather led off, describing what she'd seen in the section of the alien database that dealt with Kasari operations. Their thirst for new resources, including new species to assimilate. Many things drove them down a path of conquest, especially their powerful wormhole technology. Jennifer went next. She'd focused on gaining an understanding of the motives that drove the Altrians. At the surface, those motives seemed beneficial. To preserve freedom of choice for all species, to stop the Kasari's rampant environmental destruction, to oppose one society's aggressive conquest wherever it occurred. But Jennifer had dug deeper, seeking to find out what happened to every planet where the Altrians had engaged the Kasari. Again, her preliminary queries had yielded what seemed to be benign intent. If the Altrian ships were able to defeat the Kasari starship before a gateway could be constructed, they left the saved planet in peace. However, once the Kasari succeeded in seducing the planetary population to complete the gateway, the planet was lost. What disturbed Jennifer was that these outcomes failed to account for all the planets. Everywhere she looked, she found holes, shifted around in the database, in a way that made it extremely difficult to trace the connection. It had taken a stroke of luck to spot the first hidden data link. Frustrated with her inability to pull up detailed information on what had happened to some of the planets, Jennifer had backed off, reviewing star system information gathered over centuries of mapping and monitoring the galaxy. Jennifer filtered this data by narrowing her search to include only planetary systems she'd previously identified as Kasari-targeted systems. Suddenly, she began to find cases in which previously teeming planets were now devoid of life. The odd thing was that these weren't planets killed off by Kasari consumption of resources. Neither were they planets where the Kasari had been defeated before gateway construction had begun. Instead, they were the planets on which, according to a previous search, the population had been attempting to build a gateway. Then, all subsequent military data had disappeared. It was as if that data had been purged from the Bandolier ship's database. But why had the Altrians purged the military record of how these planets died? If the Kasari had been responsible, then surely the data would have been maintained. Even if the Altrians had managed to crush the Kasari after they had assimilated the planet's inhabitants, it would have counted as a victory. So something else had happened. Something they wanted to hide. At this point, Jack interrupted the telling.
So what do you make of it?
Jennifer hesitated a second before speaking. I think if the Altrians decided they were about to lose a world, they attempted to kill the entire population before the gateway could be completed. As much as she hated the idea, Heather found herself nodding in agreement. Mark's silence spoke for itself.
So, how did they do it?
Jack asked.
I don't know, said Jennifer. All that data got wiped.
Heather shifted in her seat.
I doubt the Altrians ever loaded that into the Bandolier ship's database.
Janet turned toward Mark.
What about the AI?
It was a no-show. No sign of it at all. And I was looking.
Maybe that's a good thing.
I wouldn't count on it, said Mark.
Jack rose, moving to the edge of the porch, looking toward the east, where a sliver of the full moon peeked over the horizon. If someone had painted little hands below it, it would have looked like a neon Kilroy was here, drawing.
We're in a tight spot.
About to get tighter, Heather said. I think Stevenson was behind the November anomaly, probably using the Rose ship to generate it. Now he's going to use that as the reason the world's governments need to build the gateway. What really sucks is if we stop this Roe project, the black hole will eat our planet. If we don't, either the Kasari horde pours through or our beloved Bandolier ship toasts us all.
That's one thing I don't get, Mark said.
Now that the AI is gone, we have complete control over the Bandolier ship's computers.
I didn't detect anything that would be some sort of trigger for a self-destruct system or anything remotely like that.
And we don't have any idea what really happened on those dead planets, Jennifer added. It might have been the AI triggering things, or, considering the people who've won that headset, it might have been the fourth crewman.
Careful. Janet's voice, low and soft, eased through the night air like a stiletto. Heather had forgotten how intimidating she could be, and apparently Jennifer had too. Realizing the implication of her words, Jennifer hastily continued.
Sorry, I forgot. Anyway, it can't be that. Robbie's just a baby.
In the moonlight, Janet's eyes flashed a silver reflection. Then, without a word, she walked back into the house, letting the screen door slam shut behind her, leaving a lump in Heather's throat and a dull ache in her heart. It seemed she just couldn't alter the destiny that made her hurt everyone she cared about.
Chapter 42 Navy Lieutenant Gordon Morrow lifted the night vision goggles from his eyes. With this level of moonlight, his platoon wasn't going to need them much tonight, at least if the action stayed out of the deep bush. If everything went according to plan, they wouldn't be going into any deep bush on this mission. Of course, in his year and a half commanding SEAL Team 10's first platoon, things had yet to go according to plan, and tonight his platoon was going to take down Jack the Ripper Gregory, so this wasn't likely to be the first time. Lieutenant Morrow excelled at two things, mission preparation and mission execution. The first of these had led him to study everything known about the Ripper's life, from the little boy who had watched his father's beheading in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to the man who had become the CIA's most feared killer. Then, after Jack's own agency had turned him out in the cold, he'd built upon that reputation as a private contractor, finally attracting the attention of NSA Director Admiral Jonathan Riles. Riles had successfully recruited Jack to the NSA, and subsequently attempted to harness Gregory's talents to bring down the Roe Project. That action had spawned the sequence of events that had brought Jack and Lieutenant Morrow to this moment. Now, in a fitting twist of fate, Jack the Ripper and his protege, Janet Price, were destined to replay Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid's final Bolivian act. Circling his right arm above his head, Morrow brought his team in tight, so that he could pass along the perimeter in one direction while his chief went the other way, physically touching and double-checking each man. A last personal check that told them more than all the high-tech gear designed to show each man's location and mission status could ever do. The high-altitude, low-opening, halo jump had gone perfectly, landing the team in an isolated clearing a little over 2 kilometers from the GPS coordinates marking the location of the Fraser Hacienda. When they had stowed the high-altitude breathing apparatus, chutes, and excess gear,
Lieutenant Morrow had been pleasantly surprised that the night jump had yielded nothing worse than a few minor scratches to any member of his 16-man team.
Now they were ready. GPS coordinates marking the objective assault positions for each special operator, along with the tight grouping of symbols that showed their current positions. Tapping his chief on the shoulder, Morrow gave the signal to move out. 16 heavily armored warriors melted into the moon shadows.
The flashing red silent alarm brought Mark to his feet in the bedroom, his powerful stride propelling him into the hall in time to see Heather already disappearing out the front door. Although they'd rehearsed the scenario hundreds of times, somehow Mark knew that tonight wasn't another drill. When he reached the comm center, he found Jack, Janet, and Heather already inside. Jennifer ran up beside him as he stepped across the threshold. Reaching the weapons locker, he grabbed his M4 assault rifle, shoulder holster with its Sig Sauer P226, and backpack filled with ammo and emergency supplies. Then he moved to his station, making room for Jennifer to arm herself. Heather had settled in front of one of the computer consoles that glowed softly in the dark room. A quick sidelong glance verified that someone had already closed all the blinds, eliminating any chance of light leakage outside the building.
"Situation report?" Jack asked.
"We've got 16 electronic signatures at 245 degrees, distance 1,800 meters," Heather responded, bringing up a map display showing the slowly moving symbols. Mark logged into his console as Jennifer reached her own station.
"Are we tied into their GPS signals yet?"
"Not yet. I'm breaking the encryption now. For the moment, we're relying on triangulation from the passive antenna array to plot their locations."
Janet moved closer to Mark.
"Jen, find out what's providing the overhead intel. It's going to be Global Hawk or U2. Mark, I want to know about the combat air support."
"On it."
Mark worked the keyboard, rapidly navigating his way through a listing of satellites capable of seeing the Fraser compound from their current orbital position. Finding what he was looking for, he typed a coordinate into his subspace transceiver, activating the hard link that tied him into the eye in the sky.
3,000 miles away, at the SEAL Team 10 Op Center just off Virginia Beach, Commander Eric Patterson cursed as one of his situational displays filled with static. Chapter 43. Heather's blood pulsed through her heart, its heat spreading out through her arteries. She felt the oxygen filter through her lungs, replacing carbon dioxide with the heady mixture that made her feel more alive than she'd ever felt. She knew that with the awesome power of the United States government targeting them, she should probably feel a measure of fear. At this moment, a team of the finest special operations soldiers in the world were moving in on their compound, backed by extensive air power that was capable of turning the entire Fraser Hacienda into a roiling ball of flame. But all she felt was an electric thrill. Off to her left, Mark spoke.
"I've got a live satellite feed on Monitor 2. Not a very good one, though. I see 3 aircraft. Looks like a Global Hawk spy bird and a couple of others."
Jack glanced at the display. "That outbound aircraft has to be the C-140. That did the halo drop. That other one's a B-52. Looks like we raid a heavy hitter, just in case the SOCOM team gets in trouble."
"Which they're about to get into," said Heather. "I've cracked the GPS encryption, ready to disrupt their signal."
Jack studied the map for several seconds before reaching out to point at a spot 600 meters to the south.
"Not too much. Send them just on the other side of this hill."
Heather nodded, her fingers entering the commands that would introduce the appropriate GPS positioning error.
"I've got control of the Global Hawk sensors, flight controls, and telemetry. I'm monitoring the incoming commands from the Global Hawk mission control element."
Jennifer joined in.
"Want me to make it go dark?"
"No," Jack said. "But I want you to replace the live feed with the last 2 minutes of recorded data from the sensor. Janet and I'll get Robbie, Yashe, and the alien headsets out, while you three keep SOCOM confused. Give us 15 minutes if you can. Then, same drill. Loop back a recorded feed,
set the explosive timers, and get the hell out.
We're not going to fight?
If that was a B-2 up there, I'd consider it. Not with a B-52 in the air. It's so old, there are lots of manual ways to get things done that we can't override with a hack. They don't need to be accurate with that baby. And we're so remote, collateral damage won't cross their minds. The second they think the assault team's in trouble, they'll blow the hell out of the whole compound. Heather took a deep breath. She was going to miss this place, but she'd known this couldn't last forever. Thank God the vicious old Nazi who'd built the compound was so paranoid he constructed an escape tunnel from beneath the master bedroom to a thickly wooded ravine 1,300 meters to the northeast.
Ready? Jack asked.
Ready,
Jennifer replied.
Start the loop back now.
Jennifer's long fingers whispered over the keyboard. When Heather looked around, Jack and Janet were already gone. Chapter 44. Lieutenant Morrow gave the signal that brought his assault team to a stop. Although he saw and heard nothing, Master Chief Hob Lucero materialized at his elbow.
Yeah, Chief.
Something seriously wrong here.
As good as Morrow was, he knew his Master Chief was better. In SOCOM, the man was a living legend. 2 silver stars, the Medal of Honor, and a chest full of so many ribbons he tilted to his left whenever he wore dress whites. But that barely hinted at the man's story. Hob was a warrior from a different age. Off duty, a gentleman straight out of King Arthur's court. In battle, a Viking warrior his men would follow into hell itself.
Yeah, I've had that feeling. But what is it?
Hob snorted.
It's this goddamned high-tech crap. This shit's screwing us. Care to be a bit more specific, Chief?
The Master Chief pulled out a map, spread it on the ground, and flipped on a red lens flashlight. His fingers circled a spot on the map.
The GPS puts us here, right?
Right.
Bullshit. I may not be one of the Pentagon's sci-fi whiz kids, but I can read a cock-sucking map well enough to know the difference between a ridgeline and a valley. We're sitting smack at the bottom of a valley, but that GPS says we're right here on top of this ridge.
Morrow stared at the paper map, then shifted his view to the GPS version on his digital display. He paused for several seconds, analyzing the disparity.
NGA hasn't spent a lot of effort producing high-quality maps of this area. Fine. I'll grant you a map error of plus or minus 100 meters, but I swear to God, we're half a click from where GPS says we are.
Which direction?
Due south.
Once again, Lieutenant Morrow paused. As much as he wanted to believe what the fancy SOCOM gadgetry was telling him, he trusted his Master Chief more.
Okay, so how do you figure it?
Sir? Didn't Gregory reprogram the GPS bird to deactivate the nanites?
He did.
So that tells me he knows we're here. And he knows how addicted to technology Special Ops has become. He's screwing us with our own technology.
Recommendation?
Somehow he's tracking us through our transmitters. We need to strip off all the high-tech gadgetry. You and me. Put it in 2 packs... Give those packs to a couple of our guys and send our team on, just like before. Then, the 2 of us veer off and deliver a little surprise to Jack the Ripper.
By the time Master Chief Hob Lucero finished proposing his plan, Morrow had already begun dropping every high-tech gadget on his body in a pile on the ground in front of him.
Chapter 45.
Almost time to go. Mark said, the watch in his head ticking off the seconds. He pointed at the map display. The SEAL team is too far off course now to get here before we're long gone.
Mark saw Heather's eyes go white, saw her stagger under the weight of her vision, and reached out a hand to support her. As her eyes cleared, she shook her head.
Escaping through the tunnel and blowing the compound isn't going to work. The Global Hawk's synthetic aperture radar and infrared sensors are just too good. They'll see us through the surrounding jungle. After that, there'll be no escaping the B-52.
Turning her attention back to her console,
Heather redirected her subspace receiver transmitter at the B-52.
I've got control of the B-52 targeting system.
Heather's voice sounded tight in her throat.
I thought we couldn't do that.
It's possible for the crew to manually override my control, but only if they recognize what's happening. That's not going to happen until it's too late.
Too late for what? Asked Jennifer.
Give me the SEAL team's center of mass, latitude-longitude.
The light dawned in Mark's mind. He calculated the coordinate to tenths of a decimal second, reciting it aloud.
Team spread?
173 meters.
Heather punched in the targeting data. Jennifer gasped.
We're going to kill Americans?
They're here to kill us. Her icy tone held an edge Mark had never heard from Heather, but it didn't surprise him. He could feel their training kicking in, siphoning away all paralyzing emotion. They would have to deal with those emotions at some point, just not now.
Jen, Heather continued, get ready to give me the Global Hawk feed. I'm going to want live infrared video of the SEAL team. I already have sensor control, ready any time. Mark, get me a satellite shot. Best NIIRS resolution it can do.
Mark focused on his own console.
Imagery coming down now. It's a pretty large data stream. Download will take 35 seconds.
The data appeared on the monitor to Heather's left. Members of the team visible, but without the details she wanted. Heather shook her head.
Something's wrong. I'm only seeing 14 people.
I'm still showing 16 GPS blips within that area, said Mark. Maybe a couple are terrain masked.
Heather glanced at the map display.
Can't be. The blips for the two I can't see are right next to SEALs I can see.
Suddenly Mark saw her eyes go wide again. Not good. Heather came out of her trance almost as quickly as she had entered it.
Jen, give me the Global Hawk feed now!
Where the hell did my Global Hawk feed go?
Commander Patterson's voice came from a spot immediately behind Chief Petty Officer Swan's right ear.
I don't know, sir. One second the signal was great, and now it's like the bird quit transmitting.
You talking to the Global Hawk mission control element?
They're working it, boss.
Not good enough. Those are my men in harm's way out there. You tell those Air Force video jockeys, if they don't get my video feed working right now, they're gonna find my boots so far up their asses, they'll be gagging on laces. Wilco.
Swan had heard that tone before. It was the sound of one pissed-off Navy SEAL. Mark watched as Jennifer directed the Global Hawk's powerful infrared camera, panning across the SEAL platoon's position. 14 SEALs, not 16.
Bring it back to us, Heather said. Give me eyes on this compound, white hot.
The infrared image shifted from black hot to white as the camera zoomed in on the Fraser Hacienda's headquarters.
Shit!
Mark's exclamation escaped his lips as he saw the two glowing white forms kneeling by the barn, less than 50 meters from the comm center where they now stood. By the time the single syllable reached the ears of the two girls, he was already at a dead run. The Sig Sauer 9mm pistol rising into firing position as the window and blinds exploded inward. From the corner of his eye, he saw Heather press her laptop's enter key. 45,000 feet above, the B-52's bomb bay doors began to open.
Chapter 46.
Lieutenant Morrow knelt in the darkness. His M4 leveled to provide covering fire for his Master Chief, should that become necessary. But it wasn't going to be. Master Chief Lucero had already applied the setting from the laser rangefinder to the non-lethal munition that currently occupied the chamber of his M25 counter-defilade rifle, his finger tightening on the trigger. The M25 normally fired high-explosive airburst rounds. It was a lovely weapon that denied enemies the chance of hiding behind walls or ledges. The user just aimed the sight at the wall or windowsill, got the range from the laser sight, thumbed in an extra meter, and fired just above the ledge. The munition's safe arm circuit armed it 30 meters downrange, the round continuing on to the programmed range before exploding.
Bye-bye, bad guy.
But if possible, This was a live capture mission, so the Master Chief had loaded the magazine with non-lethal rounds, the troops had nicknamed Goobers. These little guys armed themselves upon exiting the barrel, but exploded at the programmed distance. The difference was the way they splashed the target with an instant drying goo with a tensile strength greater than that of superglue. To get the target free from a goober, you had to apply a special spray-on solvent. Gazing through the thermal sight, Maru could clearly see the heat signatures of three people gathered near computers through the drawn window blinds. With a thump, the round accelerated from the N-25 short barrel. Almost simultaneously, one of the three people inside spun toward the window, moving with impossible speed. The glowing figure drew its sidearm as it raced toward the window. The Ripper. The thought flashed into Morrow's mind as the grenade penetrated the blinds, exploding 1 meter beyond, detonating exactly as programmed. The goober filled the room with sticky strands and globs, trapping everything it touched in a rapidly hardening web that would have made Spider-Man salivate. Maru could see the blast catch the running man, spinning him backward in the air, then locking him in place before he hit the floor. The other two figures also froze to their positions in front of the computer consoles. The man he had tagged as the Ripper continued to struggle against the tremendous tensile strength of the aerogel, and although Maru had been told that such a thing was impossible, he appeared to be breaking some of the strands, the weapon in his hand gradually rising toward the two special operators.
"Enough of this!"
Maru fired a single round into each of the three individuals, the trank darts burying themselves deep in the target's exposed flesh. For several seconds the webbed man continued to struggle, but then he, like the other two before him, hung limp in the clutches of the goo web. Beside Maru, Hob Lucero rose up, lifting the goo solvent sprayer as he stepped toward the target.
"Mission accomplished."
Maru hesitated, scanning the area with his thermal scope, seeking additional heat signatures. Intel had said to expect 5 baddies. Just as he had convinced himself that the action was over and turned to follow his Master Chief, the sky burned white and orange. Then the shock wave lifted and flung him like a rag doll in the wind.
Chapter 47.
Flashes lit the southwestern sky brighter than a Bolivian sunrise, the fireball rolling above the bomb line, swirling high in its own heat tornado, 5 seconds before the blast wave passed over the deep canyon. Janet glanced down at Robbie's wide eyes, expecting her child's scream, but failing to have her mother's expectation rewarded. Although his tiny hands pressed tightly to his ears, her baby's face held a look of awed fascination. 10 feet to her left, Jack's black-clad form stared back toward the hacienda.
"Are you going back?"
Janet's voice seemed a whisper in her own ringing ears.
"No point," Jack replied. "Either they're already in the tunnel and will catch us, or they're dead."
Janet shrugged off the wave of dread that clenched her heart, snuggled the M4 up against Robbie's front pack, and turned to follow Yashe down into the outstretched arms of the Amazon.
Chapter 48.
"Mr. President, we have a solid update from Bolivia."
James Nobles pressed a button on the remote control, replacing the large screen monitor's map display with an infrared image showing some thatch-roofed buildings and a number of glowing figures spread out around the compound.
"Go on."
"SEAL Team 10 has its second platoon on the ground at the Fraser compound. Perimeter is secure."
"First platoon?"
"I'm sorry, Mr. President. It's not good. 14 KIA. Lieutenant Maru, the first platoon commander, has a broken arm, but remains on the scene, coordinating with second platoon."
"Gregory?"
"No sign of him or Janet Price."
"Damn it! What the hell went wrong?"
"We don't know for sure yet, but early indications are that they managed to hack into a number of secure national systems."
President Jackson felt the blood drain from his face.
"How is that possible?"
"We don't know.
Find out.
His national security advisor nodded.
We've recovered 2 laptops from the Fraser compound. The information on those computers could prove invaluable.
2 laptops. It felt like a hollow prize, especially considering the loss of life. There was a pause. Then his advisor said,
But that's not all, sir. The Ripper and Janet Price had help. Significant help.
The president felt hope rise within him. Perhaps the mission hadn't been a total disaster.
We're still getting an injury assessment, but SEAL Team 10 reports the capture of 3 terrorists. We think they might have been the hackers who inserted errors into the GPS feed and took control of our Global Hawk sensors. They also managed to retarget the B-52 payload, killing 14 of our Navy SEALs. We're bringing them and the 3 terrorists to one of our special facilities. Interrogation may take some time, depending on the condition of the detainees and the interrogation methods you authorize.
President Jackson didn't pause.
You have my direct authorization to use any methods required.
As his advisor nodded and headed for the door, the president held up a hand.
Oh, and James, in case somebody has forgotten, I want Gregory. Dead will be just fine.
Chapter 49.
Dr. Louis Dubois sat in his office staring at the computer screen, his red-veined eyes testament to the fact he hadn't slept in 36 hours. Despite the angry grip captivity had on the quarantined scientists, engineers, and technicians under his direction, their professionalism and love of their work had again produced spectacular results. First phase analysis of Dr. Stevenson's design had found no fault with his equations, which meant, considering the hatred the LHC team directed at the Roe Project physicist, Stevenson's theory was correct. True science revolved around peer review to validate a Confederate's work. The more controversial the paper, the harder other scientists and mathematicians tried to find its weaknesses. The fact that this massive collection of the world's greatest minds couldn't punch a hole in Dr. Stevenson's work didn't prove he was right, but it was good enough for Louis. And that frustrated the hell out of him. As he stared at the engineering report, a cold sweat dripped down the back of his neck, dampening his once dapper ponytail and staining his shirt collar. The project to build what Louis had dubbed the Roe Gate would require an effort that dwarfed the construction of the Large Hadron Collider. Not in physical size. The device itself would be contained within an expansion of the Atlas Chamber. But its complexity, the power required to generate the wormhole, and the 7-month timeline for its construction, that combination truly boggled the mind. It would take a project the like of which the Earth had never known. Louis brought up the computer-aided design diagram of the Roe Gate. The exploded CAD diagram filled screen after screen. For the LHC engineering team to have produced this level of detail for the Roe Gate in such a short time represented a monumental effort, one that should have even impressed Donald Stevenson. Of course it hadn't, but that hardly mattered. It meant the world had a chance, slim as it might have been, at survival. It was up to Louis to put together a draft proposal to the politicians of the world's greatest powers that would get them all on board without delay. Popping the top on another energy drink, Dr. Dubois tilted back his head and drained it. Staring down at the tiny bottle, he grinned. Another 6 of these and he should be just about finished.
Chapter 50.
Gil McFarland watched as the 2 FBI men walked up his driveway, a mixture of hope and dread preceding them through the open front door. Gil directed the agents, clad in identical navy blue suits, white shirts, and black ties, into the living room, where Anna and the Smythes waited expectantly. The agents remained standing as Gil took a seat beside Anna, taking her trembling hand in his.
Mr. and Mrs. Smythe and McFarland,
the agent on the left began.
I'm Special Agent Crowley, here with Special Agent McKee.
Have you found our kids?
The word spewed from Anna McFarland's mouth,
an accusation befitting the setting. Agent Crowley pursed his lips, inhaled deeply, and continued.
I'm sorry to say we have. At around midnight last night, they died during a SEAL team raid on a terrorist compound operated by Jack the Ripper Gregory.
The words hammered Gill in the chest, a battering ram that expelled his breath in a ragged gasp.
No!
Linda Smythe's agonized cry was the only other sound to break the stunned silence.
As the Navy SEALs entered his Bolivian compound, the Ripper executed your children with a single shot to the head before detonating a booby trap that killed 14 members of the SEAL team attempting their rescue. We're here to express the United States government's deepest sorrow for your loss.
Time froze. Gil McFarland finally broke the silence.
Wait just a minute. We call you bastards in to help our kids, and now you lay this crock of shit on us? You killed them!
Moving toward the door, Agent Crowley spoke.
I know this is hard.
Hard? You sorry sons of bitches!
Fred Smythe's voice cracked with emotion. The glass lamp left Gil's hand before he noticed that he'd risen, and appeared to sail across the room in slow motion. As the two FBI agents ducked out, it exploded into the edge of the closing door, sending a hail of multicolored fragments chasing them into the white rock night. Gil took two steps forward, then stopped, his knees threatening to give way beneath him. The sound of Anna's low wail and Linda's sobs turned him around. There on the leather couch, the two women clung together, their heads pressed into each other's shoulders. Beside them, Fred stood staring at the door, hands clenched so firmly at his sides that the veins bulged in his arms. And as Gil watched rage and frustration chain his best friend in place, he felt his whole world crumble around him.
Chapter 51.
The dream was an old one. At least, it had that old, worn-out shoe feel to it, easy to slide into, but not particularly comfortable once you were inside. It unspooled in Heather's drug-induced sleep. Her perfect memory somehow warped and amplified until each heartbeat sounded like the pounding of a bass drum. In the small gym was a mirrored wall. Along that wall ran a dancer's balance rail. Across the room was a weight rack, Mark handcuffed to it. Four brutes held her pinned to the floor, legs spread. Don Espinosa kneeling between them, fumbling with his belt, button, and zipper, ripping open her blouse, grabbing her breasts. He was taunting Mark. A husky laugh escaped the drug lord's lips as he turned his attention back to his pecker. Kathum! She could feel Mark's heart hammer his chest clear across the room. Kathum! How could these men fail to hear it? Heather had seen this in her vision, the inevitable consequence of spitting in Espinosa's face. She'd had other options, but none quite as exciting or satisfying as this one. So she'd spit a wad between the drug lord's eyes and let the dominoes topple one onto the next. Then Mark was among them, crushing, ripping, tearing, their screams drowned in the bloody downpour. But Mark hadn't killed them. Heather had. And God help her, she'd enjoyed it. The dream shifted. Glass exploded into the comm center as Heather pressed the laptop's gunmetal gray enter key, sending a rack of 2,000-pound bombs raining down on the American SEAL team. Blood and fire. Again, she'd chosen the path. Jack's plan had called for them to divert the SEAL team, then move through the same secret tunnel he and Janet had taken, setting off the explosives that would turn the Fraser compound into an inferno, leaving little for the SEAL team to investigate. But Heather had overridden that plan, opting instead for the path of death and destruction. She'd known the risk. She'd known she'd be killing Americans. She felt herself lifted, flung into the air, wrapped in sticky goo that ensnared her body so completely she never hit the ground. Stunned, Heather hung in the rapidly solidifying web, until this drug-induced fog replaced the sharp pain of the trank dart in her thigh.
Doctor, she's coming around.
The voice wormed its way through the mist. Heather opened her eyes, blinking at the brilliant white surrounding her. She was strapped to a bed in some sort of hospital room. Check that. Her surroundings included some hospital room characteristics. An IV bag hung from a steel stand, dripping its contents into the clear plastic tube connected to the needle in her arm. A portable monitor displayed her vital signs. But there, the similarities stopped. This room was soft white, with padded walls and white rubber flooring. Heather glanced at the nurse, a plain blonde woman, slightly overweight, with a white nurse's uniform, even an old-fashioned white nurse's hat. The doctor stepped around the nurse and into Heather's field of view. That face, framed by dark hair, pulled back in a severe knot. Heather's breath caught in her throat. What the hell was Dr. Gertrude Zsigmond doing here? Wherever here was. The psychiatrist smiled down at her, that familiar concerned smile that always preceded a prescription change to a more powerful antipsychotic drug.
Hello, Heather. Good to see you've returned to us. How are you feeling?
Heather fought to clear her head, but the fog refused to lift. Her glance shifted to the plastic IV bag. The white tape that normally held an identifying label was blank.
What's that?
Heather's words came out slightly slurred. Once again, Dr. Zsigmond smiled.
Don't worry about that right now. The important thing is that you are lucid. Where am I? You're a very fortunate young lady. Thanks to the generosity of an anonymous benefactor, you're a patient in the finest facility of its type in North America. The Henderson Foundation Psychiatric Research Hospital. Henderson House?
A wave of dread swirled her mental fog. Dr. Zsigmond laughed, a soft chuckle meant to be reassuring, that failed to produce the desired effect.
That name has suffered a bit of bad press over the past few months, hasn't it? Let me put your mind at ease. The psychiatric wing is completely separate from the experimental facility that housed Dr. Frell's research, although it shares the same grounds. It's sad that a man like Frell could damage this fine institution's reputation.
Heather closed her eyes, trying to bring the facts into focus.
Why am I here? Where are Mark and Jennifer?
Dr. Zsigmond pulled up a chair and sat down beside Heather's bed. She reached out to pat the back of Heather's right hand, just below the leather cuff that secured it to the stainless steel rail.
Heather, you've experienced a severe psychotic episode, brought on by the fact that you stopped taking a medication. For the last several weeks, you've been locked deep in one of your trances, until you were transferred here. I was beginning to think we'd lost you forever. As for your two friends, they're still back in Los Alamos, of course, finishing out the school year. I hear Marcus is quite the basketball star.
Lies. But how could Dr. Zsigmond be involved in all of this? It didn't make sense.
But Mark was banned from sports. And what about Bolivia? Well, as for Mark's suspension, the local communities of Los Alamos and White Rock raised such a fuss, the school board ended up rescinding the school activities ban for all three of you. Prove it to me. I want to see my parents. I want to see Mark and Jen.
Dr. Zsigmond pursed her thin lips.
I'll discuss it with your doctors, but I don't want you to get your hopes up, at least not right away. Any little variation in your treatment could send you right back into deep psychosis, and next time, we might not get you back. My doctors? Aren't you my doctor?
That laugh again.
Me? Thank you for thinking of me in that light. But you're now under the care of some of the world's finest mental health researchers. They only flew me out here so that you'd see a familiar face welcoming you back to reality. Someone to ease the stress. Now that I've accomplished that task, I'll be returning to my Los Alamos practice. But...
Dr. Sigmund rose to her feet.
But nothing. You need to rest and focus on getting better. Trust me. Trust your doctors. They really are the very best.
Dr. Sigmund paused at the door, her gaze lingering on Heather's prone form. For a moment, Heather thought she would speak again. Then, the psychiatrist turned and walked out of the room. As the door closed behind her, Heather heard the heavy electric lock snap into place. The two federal agents who met Gertrude at the next door led her down a long hallway, and then a shorter one on the right, stopping to punch an illuminated elevator call button. It turned red, but she noticed the lack of floor indicator lights. If this whole episode hadn't been so surreal, she might have thought that odd. As the elevator doors whisked open, the taller of the two men, the one who'd introduced himself as Agent Sampson, stepped in beside her, pressing the topmost of five unmarked buttons. The doors closed, and the elevator accelerated upward. When it stopped, the doors remained closed. Agent Sampson extended his hand.
Dr. Sigmund, you've done your country a great service.
Have I?
And I'm sure I don't need to remind you not to mention your visit here, subject to severe punishments specified under the Patriot Act.
Gertrude ignored the hand, and Agent Sampson withdrew it.
May I go now?
He pressed the middle button and the door slid open. Walking her to the guard desk, Agent Sampson waited as she turned in her temporary security badge and signed out. As Gertrude stepped out of the building into the underground parking garage, she let her gaze wander to the waiting government sedan. Agent Sampson let her slide into the back seat and closed the door, slapping the roof to signal the driver he was clear to go. As the black sedan drove out through the gates of Fort Meade, Gertrude cast one more glance over her shoulder.
Would you like to stop for something to eat, or should I take you directly to the airport?
Gertrude shook her head.
Just take me to BWI.
She hadn't eaten today, but a wave of nausea wiped away all traces of hunger. All she wanted to do was get on her airplane, take an antidepressant, go to sleep, and hope she didn't still hate herself when she awakened. Chapter 52. If there was a U.S. airport that moved at a slower pace than Baltimore Washington International, Freddie Hagerman hadn't been there. But what could you expect from a Union town? Just getting to the security checkpoint was a nightmare that forced you to fight your way down an endless hallway barely wide enough for one person, just to turn around and join the end of the line of people coming back the other direction. On his trip out, Freddie had fought that fight for 37 minutes before finally making it to the TSA screeners. Then, just when he thought that hell was over, he'd been forced to wait at the damned machine while one TSA woman chatted to the one at the next machine about her cheating boyfriend, and did Sheila think she should dump him or just beat the crap out of him? When Freddie decided he'd had enough and made that fact loudly known, he'd been singled out for a detailed pat-down that caused him to miss his flight. Now he was back, waiting in the run-down baggage claim area along with about 300 other people, trying to decide if today was a baggage delivery holiday. After all, it was Wednesday, and who really worked on Wednesday, right? It reminded him of a line in one of the Lethal Weapon movies. They screw you at the drive-thru. Maybe so, but BWI screws you coming and going. Not that it really mattered, the way he'd been spinning his wheels trying to follow up on the Dr. Jennings tip. 3 days in Manhattan trying to shake some information out of his UN sources had been a total waste of time. Combine that with everything he'd been able to dig up in D.C., and he had a bag full of nada. At that moment, the warning horn blared three sharp bleats and the baggage conveyor rumbled into motion. 5 minutes later, Freddie pulled his spotted vinyl suitcase out the sliding glass doors, turning right toward the bus that would take him to the rental car center. He'd taken a half dozen steps when he spotted the government sedan. The driver got out of the car and moved to the trunk to help a slender, dark-haired woman lift her computer case from the trunk. Freddie stopped,
Where had he seen her? He never forgot a face, but the fact that he was having difficulty remembering where he'd seen this one meant he'd only seen it in passing. Her driver was clearly some sort of federal agent. The way his jacket bunched along his left side as he hefted her bag meant he was packing more than her valise. Setting the wheeled case on the sidewalk, the agent gave a curt nod, got back in the car, and pulled out into traffic. As Freddy redirected his attention to the woman, now pulling the lavender case through the same sliding glass doors Freddy had just exited, it came to him. Her hair, pulled back so tightly she'd never need a facelift, triggered his memory. She was the psychiatrist in the Newsweek article about the three missing high school kids from Los Alamos. Freddy had read the piece several months ago while he was working on the Henderson House story. So why was a small-town psychiatrist from Los Alamos being escorted around the D.C. area by the feds? She hadn't looked too happy about it either. Come to think of it, why had they dropped her off at the baggage claim area instead of departures? 50 yards down the street, the rental car bus pulled away from the curb. Damn! He'd stood around so long trying to figure out where he'd seen the woman, he'd missed the bus. Now he'd have to wait for the next one, and this being BWI, that meant he'd be cooling his heels for another half hour. Glancing back at baggage claim, Freddy spotted the psychiatrist standing in a line at the lost baggage counter. Well, that explained the drop-off location.
Hey, buddy!
Freddy's gaze shifted to the speaker. A fat white guy with a rumpled suit and two suitcases glared at him.
You gonna stand there blocking the sidewalk all day, or you gonna move?
Freddy returned the glare, but stepped back and let the wide load pass without comment. Once again, Freddy shifted his gaze back to the woman. She was clearly upset, and Freddy didn't think it had anything to do with her lost luggage. The McFarland girl had been her patient, and according to the news coverage of the raid on the Ripper's Bolivian hideout, she and her two high school friends had died during that raid, along with 14 special ops soldiers. That would certainly account for the anguish he read on the psychiatrist's face. But it didn't account for her being here with federal agents, a dozen miles from NSA headquarters. Why would the feds want to talk to McFarland's psychiatrist if she really was dead? The parents, maybe. Psychiatrist? He wasn't buying it. Standing on the sidewalk on what was destined to be Baltimore's first hot day of the year, Freddy felt a hot lead tug at him. The first such feeling he'd had since his meeting with that NSA spook, Jennings. Maybe it wasn't the same story, but it grabbed his attention. Reaching for his cell phone, Freddy speed-dialed his admin assistant.
It's me. Listen, Lisa. Change of plan. Book me on the first available flight from BWI to Albuquerque.
Yeah. Rental car in Albuquerque. Hotel room in Los Alamos. I'm not sure how long.
Better make it for a week.
Ending the call, Freddy slid his iPhone back in his pocket and grabbed his bag. Feeling a scowl tug at the corners of his mouth, Freddy trundled back toward ticketing. The military had an acronym for this. BOHICA. Bend over, here it comes again. It looked as if BWI was going to get one more go at him today after all.
Chapter 53. The room held a faintly acrid scent, a hint of recently dried adhesive, plus something else. Heather turned her head so she could see her vital signs on the monitor, memorizing them at a glance. The drugs were affecting her thought processes, but before she did something about that, she needed to know what her drugged readings looked like so she could keep those in the same range. The body's autonomic nervous system was an amazing thing. Without a single conscious thought, it kept her heart beating, lungs breathing, and blood circulating, adjusted bodily cooling, digested food, and on. These things continued whether she was sleeping or awake. One of the many advantages she, Mark, and Jen enjoyed was the ability to enforce a high degree of control over these processes. Heather shifted her attention to the haze that affected her thinking. This wasn't the high-powered tranquilizer they'd stuck in her thigh in Bolivia. Neither was it Thorazine or any of the other phenothiazine-derivative antipsychotic meds Dr. Sigmund had tried on her back in Los Alamos. Taking a deep breath, Heather executed Mark's meditation trick, pulling forth the perfect memory of how it felt to be clear-headed and alert. Within Heather's brain, underutilized neurons compensated for her drugged state, remapping her neural net to achieve the desired mental acuity. Another glance at the monitor rewarded her with the knowledge that no one would detect the fact she'd just rendered the drugs ineffective. Once again, Heather turned her thoughts to the smells that hung on the air. Remodeling smells. The spot where white padded walls butted up against the ceiling's acoustic tiles still showed evidence of recent installation. A stainless steel toilet and sink occupied the center of the rear wall, and a rudimentary shower drained into the left rear corner. Those, her bed, with its scratched frame and railing, and the small video camera in the upper right front, were the room's only decorations that weren't freshly installed. Heather brought up the room dimensions, forming a 3D model in her head. She rotated it, stripped away the asylum padding from the walls, removed the acoustic tiles from the ceiling, replaced the front wall and door with tempered steel bars, an electronically controlled sliding steel gate, and a chuck hole for pushing in meals. This wasn't Henderson House, and it wasn't a psychiatric facility. It was a recently converted solitary confinement cell in a supermax detention facility. So why had the government gone to all this effort to throw together this fake? Obviously, Dr. Sigmund had been flown in to establish early credibility, something the drugs were intended to augment. They'd pulled Heather's records, identified a mental weakness, and now they were determined to exploit it. There was a certain irony to it. By trying to exploit her weakness, her captors had provided her with an advantage she could play to. She felt the leather cuffs binding her hands and feet to the bed, flexed her muscles just enough to build an estimate of their tensile strength. Breaking free from her bonds wouldn't be a problem, but she wasn't going to do that while they were watching her with that camera. Before she made her break for freedom, she had a lot to learn about the routine, this facility, and the people behind this operation. The thought of Mark and Jennifer worried her, but she knew their capabilities and training. The best way she could help them was to handle her own situation. A distant sound caught her attention. The scuffing of two pairs of rubber-soled shoes on concrete. The noise had a reverb echo that indicated a long hallway, an impression that was reinforced by the amount of time the footsteps took to reach her door. With an electric click, the door opened to admit two men in medical scrubs, a tall, blue-eyed blonde wearing a stethoscope around his neck, and a short, bald man holding an Apple iPad. The one with the stethoscope stepped up beside her bed.
"Hello, Heather. My name is Dr. Jacobs. This is my physician's assistant, Frank Volker. It's good to see you decided to come back to us." Heather let a slight slur creep into her voice.
"Did I?"
Jacob smiled.
"Yes, and you should be proud of that accomplishment. Most people in your condition never find their way back."
Heather glanced down at her hands.
"Why am I tied down?"
Jacobs patted her right hand, giving it a slight squeeze.
"It's for your own protection, at least until we've formed an understanding of just where you're at."
"For my protection?"
Jacob sat down in the chair next to her bed.
"Just until we're sure you're stable, that you're not going to suffer an immediate relapse. It's why we're keeping you mildly sedated. Do you remember anything at all about your stay here?"
Volker tapped away on the iPad's touchscreen. Heather frowned.
"I remember Bolivia."
"I'm not talking about your alternate reality right now. I'm talking about the months you've been in this facility."
"The first time I ever saw this place was when I woke up to see Dr. Sigmund standing over me. Like I told her, I want to see my mom and dad."
A serious expression settled on Dr. Jacob's face. "Believe me, I want that for you too. We all do. But you've been through a hell of a mental trauma these last few months, and as hard as it is for you to understand why, we're going to go slow and careful about reintroducing you to the real world. For now, that means no TV, no radio, no internet, and unfortunately, No friends or family. Heather squeezed her eyes shut.
So I'm just supposed to lie here, drugged and chained to the bed, and trust you?
I didn't say this was going to be easy. A bitter laugh escaped Heather's lips. Tell you what, Dr. Jacobs continued. I'll get you out of these restraints as soon as we finish a battery of tests. Then, if you work with me and learn to recognize the difference between what's real and what's not, then we'll get your parents out here to California for a visit. But, Heather, you're going to have to trust me. Dr. Jacobs rose to his feet, patted her hand again, and turned toward the door. Volker switched off his iPad and followed.
Can I at least go to the bathroom?
I'll have a nurse bring a bedpan.
Doctor!
Heather raised her voice just enough to cause him to turn back toward her.
Right now my alternate reality looks pretty damn good.
Jacob's face acquired a sympathetic cast. You can't beat this by yourself, Heather. But we can. You just have to let me in. As the door closed behind them, Heather concentrated on their footfalls, the sounds plus their echoes rendering an image in her mind. A hallway, all right. 11.5 feet wide, 10 feet tall, and really, really long. Another piece of her facility blueprint filled in, and when the nurse brought her the bedpan, Heather would see whether it was the same one who had assisted Dr. Sigmund. Heather looked up at the camera, then closed her eyes, gradually letting her vital signs drop. They expected her to be exhausted, so she'd feed them the data they wanted. Heather smiled inwardly at the thought. Just like training Pavlov's dog. Chapter 54. Deep in her drug-induced dreams, Jennifer found herself at the McFarlane breakfast table, seated beside Mark and Heather, as Mrs. McFarlane set the platter, stacked high with her golden brown pancakes, at the table's center. She recognized the scene. It was the morning after she and Mark had shared Heather's dream about the rag man. She watched it unfold around her, a disembodied ghost, unable to make herself known to any of the participants. With a pang of regret, Jennifer knew those days were gone forever. The dream shifted to another morning at the McFarlane table. Her other self glanced at Heather, who seemed unusually distracted this morning. What's up with Heather? She heard herself think. Heather lifted her gaze to Jennifer's.
What was that?
It was as if Heather had heard her, even though she hadn't said the thought aloud. Again the dream shifted, this time to the night she'd run from her room to meet Mark at the top of the stairs. Heather had called out to them in pain and terror, her thoughts reaching into their minds as she'd been carried off by the ragman, and her thoughts had guided Mark through that dark night to find her. These experiences were completely different from Jennifer's ability to read and influence people's emotions. She, Mark, and Heather had been able to share their thoughts, and they'd done it without wearing the alien headsets. How? And why hadn't they managed to do that same thing on demand? Her questions focused her thoughts, pushing back the drug haze as she called upon her brain for answers. She felt a chill run down her spine. Finding the answers to those questions suddenly acquired an importance that drove her to an ever tighter level of concentration. Jennifer shoved the drug haze aside, isolating its effects to a small portion of her mind as she called upon the full extent of her analytical abilities. The alien headsets were the key. She was sure of it. The first time she'd stood inside the bandolier ship and felt the headset establish a link between her brain and the ship's computer, she'd felt it alter her brain. Not exactly rewiring the connections, but forcing activity across the entire structure. Neural connections that had been so weak that they were dormant had come to life, able to be accessed and put to work in ways that had previously been impossible. When she, Mark, and Heather put on the headsets, they could share thoughts. In fact, if they weren't careful, the others could penetrate into private areas, accessing thoughts and feelings not meant for sharing. Jennifer thought about that. The headset picked up the thoughts from their minds, transferring the impulses to the bandolier ship via a subspace link.
But how had they occasionally managed to establish a similar link between themselves without the headsets? Distances weren't the same in subspace. It wasn't the same as the way gravitational effects warped the space-time fabric. Instead, subspace had its own wave transmission speed, and that relationship between time and distance defined their meaning just as the speed of light did in our universe. Jennifer had seen it for herself, had used it to hack into remote networks, accessing their data through the subspace receiver transmitters, or SRTs. In the case of the computer hack, the system hadn't required a physical device at the far end to achieve a tap. A sudden excitement coursed through Jennifer's nerves, presaging a great discovery that nudged the corner of her awareness. She only had to relax and let down the wall that held it back. The answer was right there, so frustratingly close she could almost reach out and touch it. Why did the computer subspace hack work? You focused the SRT on an exact coordinate and then scanned for computer